You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Anya Sizladlo was a journalist in New York when she married her Lebanese-born husband, Mohammed, also a journalist. His work took them to Beirut and then Baghdad, and Anya found herself cooking and eating in a wide array of people, her Sunni and Shiite neighbors, mullahs, and American soldiers. Her memoir about those years, called Day of Honey, explores the importance of food during wartime. It's published by Free Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Anya Sizladlo to our show today. Hello.
Thank you so much for having me.
How and where did you meet your husband?
We actually first met when I was an intern at Newsday. He doesn't like
and
to talk about
that.
And he
was writing there?
He was a staff reporter. We didn't really get to know each other until after that, though. I was working for a small magazine called City Limits that covered housing, poverty, all kinds of, New York City neighborhoods, basically. And that's when we sort of started to get to know each other. He was covering transportation, which at that time I thought was just like the coolest, most glamorous, sexiest beat in the world. I was like, this guy writes about the subway and the buses and stuff like that. How cool is that? I had no idea we'd be going to the Middle East.
Well, you had your honeymoon in Baghdad?
We did. We did, actually.
That was a kind of a working honeymoon, wasn't it?
A busman's holiday, to be sure. We sort of ended up there. I kind of made this decision on the fly. I decided at the last minute to get married. I write in the book about, I was a little ambivalent about the idea of getting married. I sort of felt like, hey, look, I'm moving to Beirut with you. Isn't that enough? But we decided kind of the spur of the moment to get married. And in the same spirit, I decided that having spent a couple of years sitting by the phone in my office at City Limits, wondering if I was going to get a phone call saying that he's, lost or missing or injured, that this was traumatic enough that I didn't want to go through it again in Beirut when we relocated there, and that I would just go to Baghdad with him. I'm a journalist. Why not? And so that's what I did.
Went to Baghdad because it was right after the invasion?
No, this was in October of 2003. And so it's funny because at that time it seemed like the war was, long gone and long over. Now, of course, those days seem impossibly long ago and impossibly peaceful compared to what happened afterwards. But at the time, it was still kind of a hopeful time for a lot of Iraqis.
And what were your expectations for the way life would be in Baghdad?
It's funny. I had read a lot of books about Iraq. And, whenever I go to a new country or a new place, I try to read as many books as possible. But there was so little information about what Iraq had been like over the past 35 years, with the exception of a couple of Kenan Makiya's books. There was not much about that era. And so my expectations were completely different from what I ended up finding.
Well, of course, all those books have been written about Iraq under Saddam Hussein. And the books about post-Hussein were about to be published, but not yet.
Had yet to be published, exactly. They were being written at the time. And the books about Iraq under Saddam Hussein, a lot of them had been written by outsiders, like Michael Kelly's book, Martyr's Day, Out of the Ashes by Patrick and Andrew Coburn, I believe. That's a really good one, but you don't get a sense of day-to-day life from books like that as a rule.
Well, was day-to-day life the same as it had been before? After all, everything had been disrupted. Buildings were destroyed. I'm assuming that some farmers were reluctant to come into town with their produce.
You know what's interesting? Day-to-day life, it's hard. It's hard. All I know is what people have told me about what it was like before. But what was interesting about being there was you saw this kind of just rush of commerce. Actually, it was the reverse. In some cases, people felt more free to buy and sell. Suddenly, there was a flood of goods coming in from countries. There were no more sanctions, no more restrictions on things like books. I didn't realize this, but the Ba'ath Party had imposed controls on books that could be imported in 1970. I had thought it was much later. So you had this population that wasn't used to getting books from outside since 1970 without kind of restrictions on them. And so just things like being able to have a copy of a certain book would be exciting to people. I remember talking to an Iraqi man once who said, Now I can buy a whole kilo of bananas, that's 2 pounds, and not even worry about how much they might cost. And that just blew my mind. A kilo of bananas was like less than a dollar, you know, and this guy, it was like a miracle to him. So that gave me a picture of what it had been like before and how things had changed.
What was your husband reporting on?
It's funny. Sometimes we would report on similar things.
Because you were also sending back. Were you working for the same newspaper?
No, I was a stringer for the Christian Science Monitor and later a special correspondent, which is basically the same thing as a stringer, but a little fancier.
And he was with the Post?
And he was with Newsday.
Still with Newsday.
Yeah, he was the Middle East bureau chief for Newsday at that time. So sometimes we would go reporting together and report on the same things. And it was interesting because it was interesting to see how people reacted. They liked that idea of an American woman and a Lebanese guy and a Muslim and a Christian, and it opened a lot of doors.
Well, that made more sense in Beirut, didn't it?
In Beirut, people were a little more blasé. I think for a lot of Iraqis, it was mind-blowing enough. Like, I remember one person telling us, hey, you know, I met a Lebanese woman once 10 years ago. And just like the bananas, I mean, this was a big thing to him. It was a big deal.
But you were based in Beirut, but you were in Baghdad at the time because that's where the action was?
Yeah, we spent most of that year and then some in Baghdad. And we would go back to Beirut every once in a while to sort of, I don't know, drop off our stuff and you know, have dinner with his parents and reassure them that everything was okay.
And you were in Baghdad when Saddam Hussein was captured. What was the reaction of the people you knew, your neighbors?
It was an interesting reaction. It was not at all what I expected. I had expected a lot of joy, and particularly in the case of one friend of mine that I write about. She was Kurdish, and she had had aunts and uncles who had been killed at Halabja and you know, gassed by Saddam Hussein. And I expected jubilation, and that was not at all what happened. People felt very ambivalent about the fact that he'd been captured by the Americans. And suddenly it was this phrase that you were hearing a lot more of after that time, the Americans. For me, there were a lot of turning points in Iraq, but this was one of the most obvious. It was very, very obvious. People would literally say from that moment on, from that morning on, people would say, okay, you know, you came to get rid of Saddam. You got him. You found him. You captured him. Time to go. And if you stay here, that's going to prove to us that this is an occupation and not a liberation.
Do you think that would have been a wise move?
I think that it would have been a wise move. And look, I don't even think it. I mean, Iraqis told me this over and over and over again. If anybody from the Coalition Provisional Authority had been listening, they would have known this as well, if they had bothered to talk to Iraqis and say, hey, what do you think?
Well, the president, Barack Obama, is trying to get us out earlier. At least that's what he promised. But it seems to be dragging on because of all the problems there. Can you just pick up and leave?
You can't just pick up and leave. And I think what would have been a wise move at that time, and I think what would have allayed a lot of concerns, would be to say, hey, okay, we're not going to just pack up and be out of here next week, but this is something that we're doing, and this is something that we're handing over to Iraqis from now on. I think some kind of announcement of scaling down at that time would have been wise, simply because so many people were asking for it.
We have to talk about the food. Were you able to learn much about the local cuisine in the middle of a war zone?
I was, actually. And in fact, I write about in the book, one thing that I discovered was that asking people about food was this sort of almost magic door that would open to getting them to talk about their lives and getting them to talk in less abstract terms. Oftentimes, one of the problems when you're interviewing people, and particularly in a society that's been very, very closed for a very long time, is they can be really cautious about what's okay to say. And if I say, you know, what do you want out of life? They'll say, oh, I want dignity. I want this. I want that. And if I say, well, tell me about a day, a typical day. Tell me about your favorite holiday. Tell me how you want this to go. If you talk in specific and concrete terms, often you will find out much more than if you ask open-ended and abstract questions. And food was a very good way for me to do this.
Like talking about a dish like maskouf.
Maskouf is a really good example. For a lot of people, maskouf, people talk about it almost with this kind of reverence. And it took me a really long time to figure out why. Because it's just grilled fish, right? But what I discovered, the more I sort of pushed and interviewed and talked to people and asked people about it, was that for a lot of people, it symbolized this time before Saddam and before the Ba'ath Party had really begun to crack down on public life. It symbolized a time and a place where people could go to this riverfront corniche, this sort of riverfront promenade where mousqueff was served. And for a lot of people, it symbolized this time and place when you could go and mingle without really this fear that people were watching and listening and caring about, you know, men and women eating together or, you know, Sunnis and Shiites and things like this.
My guest is Anya Cezadlo. And I'm sorry, your name is sometimes hard to remember to pronounce. C-I-E-Z-A-D-L-O.
Yes.
The book, A Day of Honey, which is published by Free Press. Well, we're talking about Iraq, where there's a Shiite majority, Sunni minority, large Kurdish presence, a certain mm-hmm. amount of Christian presence as well. Mm-hmm. Does everybody eat the same food?
For the most part, they do, but there are certain regional specialties. And the more research I do into food in the Middle East in general is that you find that a lot of it is tied to region. And so if it becomes tied to sect or religion, there are a few dishes that are specific to certain religious rituals and things like that. But a lot of them cross over. A lot of them, for example, there's something that Shiites eat on Ashura, which is a Shiite holiday. It's a commemoration of killing of Imam Hussein. And Christians eat the exact same thing on the Feast of the Assumption. And it's also made by Yemeni Jews, apparently. And so a lot of these dishes are more specific to geography. And so you might have, for example, very, very Iranian dishes in the south of Iraq, mostly because people have had a lot of contact with people in Iran. So it's not necessarily a religious thing, but it does tend to fall out along those lines when religions are like confined or specific to a certain region.
You did some culinary research and found that some of the first written cookbooks come from the region.
Yes. Yes.
Ancient, how far back?
Ancient Mesopotamian cookbooks.
Have any of them been translated and republished? I'd be curious to know how similar the ancient cuisine is to the current cuisine.
They have been, and by a French academic in the 1980s. His name is Jean Bottero. And in this very sort of academic way, he maintains that they're absolutely not cookbooks and must not be considered as such. And he has a sort of long academic explanation of why. But what they're basically recipes and records of what they cooked in ancient Mesopotamian court society. I mean, these are very much like the sort of priestly class almost, 1600 BC. And a lot of the dishes, what's really amazing about it is that you find these sort of common threads. A lot of the dishes have things that I would recognize today. For example, making dinner with my mother-in-law, she would make a paste of cilantro and garlic and put it into the dish, into a stew, for example, a meat and vegetable stew at the very end. And this is exactly.
But that's not unique to Iraqi food.
It's not unique to Iraqi food. In fact, you find the same thing throughout the Mediterranean, for example.
Or in Mexico.
But a lot of Mexican food, bear in mind, comes from Andalusia and Spain. And so a lot of that was originally diffused from mm-hmm. Arabia. And actually some of it specifically from Baghdad, but that's another story. So a lot of these things, they travel really, really widely. And so it's really exciting to read something from, you know, 1600 BC, that's like 3,500 years ago, and say like, wow, people still do this.
How were you able to communicate with the people you were meeting? Do you speak any Arabic?
Very, very broken Arabic. It's Arabic is one of those languages you kind of have to study full time to effectively learn it. And so whenever I would start taking lessons, there would be a war or a kidnapping or a bombing. And then I would have to go into my journalist mode and drop the, you know, full time Arabic student mode. So, yeah, I can speak a little Arabic, but most of the time I would use either a translator or I would use my husband.
But you suggest that you actually felt safer in Baghdad than you did when you went to Beirut.
Safer? I don't know about safer.
Okay.
Sometimes I would feel more comfortable, but I think that just depends on sort of where you are and where you're at in a specific time or place.
But Beirut, which we think of as a more peaceful place, has had its own problems. And there have been a number of wars. There have been also, there's been some internal strife.
I've been in some pretty nasty situations in Beirut. I mean, I think you might be talking about one particular time, which was much more disturbing to me than anything that I experienced in Iraq, which was when I saw my neighbors checking IDs in my neighborhood, in our neighborhood in Beirut.
To determine what?
To determine sect. And this is something that had happened a lot during the Lebanese Civil War. And I don't know if I would say that I felt safer in Baghdad, but in Baghdad, you know, conflict is conflict and it's very sort of overt. But having my neighbors checking IDs to see the sect of people who live in the neighborhood, that was something that was very disturbing to me because it was sort of it was like going from what looks like normal, everyday, peaceful life to something that was very, very warlike. This had been used in the Civil War as a prelude to killing or disappearing people who were the wrong sect.
As an American, were you the wrong sect?
No, as an American, ironically enough, Muhammad, my husband is, you know, he's Shiite, or at least his last name would indicate that he's Shiite. He was born Shiite. And in the Civil War, no one really cares if you observe your religion or if you're, you know, religious or no one really bothers to ask. All they care about is, you know, what's your last name or, you know, where are you from, that sort of thing. And so ironically enough, we went from, you know, Muhammad would be okay in Baghdad, but we'd sort of have to hide the fact that I'm an American. And in Beirut, in this particular situation I'm writing about, there were Sunnis checking IDs in our neighborhood. They would have been probably pretty upset to find out that he was Shiite. But as an American, I was okay because we were backing them in that situation. So it was like almost a perfect reversal.
If you were in another neighborhood, would Hezbollah have been checking your IDs to find out if you were Sunni?
As indeed they have. Yeah, they probably would have. And it wouldn't necessarily even have been Hezbollah. It could have been Amal. It could have been another Shiite militia. It could have just been random people. But yeah, and in another neighborhood, in fact, in that same exact neighborhood, we walked a few blocks down the street. And then we were with the Shiite militias, where he would be perfectly okay. But it wasn't, you know, as an American, it was like, it was a bit awkward. It wasn't, I wouldn't say it was dangerous, but it was definitely, you wouldn't want to be, you know, shouting the fact that you're an American.
Did you find similar foods in Beirut?
Similar to
Baghdad?
No, actually, quite different. And this is sort of an education for me because I think we tend to think of Middle Eastern food as being somewhat monolithic, and we tend to define it as meza, which is the sort of small plates, kind of like tapas, hummus, tabbouleh, these kind of things. But a lot of these are not really indigenous to Iraq. Hummus, for example, it's not a big Iraqi thing. And in the book I write about finding this out from Iraqi friends of mine, that this was
their
something,
loss.
Well, now they have it. You know, it's something relatively recent, but they have other things that more than make up for it. So,
and you wrote an article in the Sunday's New York Times Magazine saying that people are leaving behind the traditional foods for more Western-style foods.
Diets are changing all over the world. In fact, there's even a name for this. It's called globesity from the globalized diet, this phenomenon of people increasingly wanting to eat hamburgers and French fries and things like that. And even in the Mediterranean, and ironically enough, what I write about in the article is, you know, we sort of have this ideal of the Mediterranean diet, this vaunted Mediterranean diet, and it is an ideal for us here, but often what I found in the Middle East and even in the Mediterranean was that often people have an idealized view of the Western diet. And so they love the idea, particularly the younger generations, of going to places that serve hamburgers and French fries and milkshakes and things like that.
Did you eat you had your in-laws living in Beirut, so I assume that you ate at home or in friends' homes more there than you would have in Baghdad.
Yeah.
Is there a big difference between the cuisine of restaurants and home cooking?
A huge dichotomy. And I found that both in Beirut and in Baghdad, and perhaps even more so in Baghdad because in
what
Beirut.
What did you prefer?
I wouldn't say that I preferred one cuisine over the other, but there are definitely certain dishes that
I meant home or restaurant.
Usually home cooking, honestly, I have to say. And often it was stuff that was completely unfamiliar as well. And I love exploring new kinds of foods and new dishes. And so the home cooking was something that, you know, you would see something you'd never encountered before, which was really exciting.
Was it a struggle to get your Lebanese parents-in-law to accept you?
No, actually, you know, I have to say my mother-in-law is awesome. She's one of the most accepting, you know, parents that I've ever had or known. And it was the only thing that was a struggle was communicating with her because she doesn't speak any English whatsoever, and like really not even a word or two. And so my English, my Arabic is so basic, and her Arabic is very, very Southern. She has this like very thick Southern accent. And so even words that I might recognize if they were spoken by a Beiruti, spoken by her, I'm like, huh? So we spent a lot of time learning how to communicate with each other by just cooking together. And that was one of the most fun parts to write about in the book because it was one of the most fun experiences that I had.
It's also a way of learning how to cook in a style that you're not accustomed to. And you've included a lot of recipes in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Were they recipes that have been published elsewhere, or are these things that you learned from your mother-in-law?
A lot of these things are recipes that are straight from my mother-in-law. And so not only – I tried to really focus on recipes that are hard to find in recipe books, and some I don't think are even – I haven't even found them in recipe books, particularly her version of something called mujaddara, which can be made with rice, but in the country and in sort of like very village life, it's still made with bulgur wheat. And she makes it in this very particularly Southern way that I've never seen a recipe for anywhere.
Well, you can get bulgur wheat here in New York. Are there certain ingredients that are more difficult to get?
You know, here's the thing. I tell everybody, I was on this radio show in Cleveland and places in Wisconsin. They always like, where can we get this stuff? You know, every place in America, even small towns, they've got a Lebanese grocery store. there's fantastic ones here. There's Sahadi's in Brooklyn. There's Calistian's in Manhattan. There's El Shatter in Queens. I mean, anywhere you go, you're going to find a Lebanese or Palestinian or Middle Eastern or Israeli. You're going to find this stuff. It just, you have to do a little searching. And you can order it online. It's not that hard to find.
How much can you learn from a culture, from the way that people cook? Are there differences that you learned about Lebanon and Iraq? And let me extend that a bit. What about different classes within a country?
It's interesting that you mentioned class because I think that there's been a lot written about, you know, sort of cultural anthropology and food and these sort of things. But really, class is something I haven't found as much written about. You can tell a lot about, for example, transition from rural to urban life, which is a huge factor in everything that's happening in the Middle East right now. All these revolutions, for example, you see people's ties to villages and to earlier rural ways of life in the food. Often, this is the one thing that they preserve. Just like exiles might preserve nothing, not the language, not anything, but they'll preserve the food. And often people who move to the city will preserve really nothing of rural life. In fact, they might be the kind of people who will say, you know, I never want to go back to the village again. But they'll keep that sort of memory of hardship and rural life and peasant life in their cooking and in their food.
But they do have to make adjustments during wartime, don't they?
Absolutely. And one thing that I found really interesting and one thing that I saw in the war that I lived through in Beirut was that often people reverted back to these sort of earlier rural, like peasant and traditions that came really out of times of famine even, because they couldn't get access to certain things. For example, couldn't get access to lemons during the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah. And so what a lot of people used was this kind of – it's called verjuice. It's available here even. It's the juice of unripe green grapes, and it has this amazing flavor. And it's what people used to use in the past because you couldn't have lemons all year round. So in the past, when people didn't have access to lemons, they would use this to flavor their tabbouleh. It's got this like amazing kind of round, warm flavor. It's very, very different, and it's a very interesting taste. And people would go back to this, something that they would, you know, maybe remember from their youth. And there were other examples that I talk about in the book of people sort of reverting to these kind of ancient memories that they had, old aunties coming out and saying, okay, well, we don't have rice, but we're going to stuff our grape leaves with bulgur wheat or even with tabbouleh because we don't even have any grain, things like this.
What does your title, Day of Honey, refer to?
It's an old Arabic proverb, and it rhymes in Arabic. It's Yom Asal, Yom Basal. It's Day of Honey, Day of Onions. And it kind of means a lot of different things depending on who says it and in what context. But most of the time I've heard it being used, it's maybe to comfort people and say, hey, well, you know, things might be bad now, but they'll get better, God willing. And so it's got this kind of philosophical, like almost, I would say it's a way of looking at the world. Like, you know, things might be bad, but you don't lose your faith in human nature. You know, maintain hope.
Now that you're not working there, how often do you get back?
I go for about three or four months a year in the summer.
Oh, that much?
Yeah. Yeah, Muhammad, usually go.
Anya says Adlo's book is called Day of Honey, a memoir of food, love, and war. It's published by Free Press. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you so much for having me.